This is Playback Daily for Thursday, the 11th of March. I'm Gemma Craddock, and here's a look ahead at some of today's selections.
And that was ultimately the reason why I came forward, was, you know, the first one was to reassure victims of rape and sexual violence that you're not alone and you really have nothing to hide or feel ashamed of.
It is one of the anomalies that we think of masculinity, you know, as being the gender which takes risks, when in fact women are taught from the very beginning that to engage in the public world, and indeed sometimes the domestic world, is to take risks.
It's what would be said about her is, why was she walking at that hour? The woman from Black Hall that you've just been speaking to, why was she going out at 7 o'clock in the morning for a walk on her own? Why not? Is my answer, why not?
Now, I try to bring you a selection of all topics discussed across the day with all the light and shade. But things definitely took a dark turn today, with a focus on violence against women and the ways in which victims of violence have been failed by the system. There's been plenty of talk on air and online this week about two particular cases from two different jurisdictions. We heard of the sentencing of a 21-year-old man in relation to the attempted abduction of a 69-year-old woman out for her morning walk on Blackhorse Avenue. In her victim impact statement, she has said that her life has been irreparably changed. And another story that has struck a chord with many is that of Londoner Sarah Everard, who disappeared while walking home from a friend's house. Human remains have now been found in the search for Sarah, and a serving police officer has been arrested on suspicion of murder. Morning Ireland brought us this clip of London's head of Metropolitan Police, Cressida Dick, describing the shock within the force at news of the officer's arrest.
The news today that it was a Metropolitan Police officer who was arrested on suspicion of Sarah's murder has sent shockwaves and anger through the public and through the Met. I speak on behalf of all my colleagues when I say that we are utterly appalled at this dreadful, dreadful news.
Rachel English then spoke to Sky News reporter Enda Brady, who brought us up to date on the latest in the case.
So all day yesterday, police in Kent searched two locations. There was a property in the town of Deal, which is a small seaside town just north of Dover. There was frenzied police activity there, a lot of forensic work going on. They put up metal sheeting to keep prying eyes away from what they were doing. They had a forensics tent in the front garden, and they removed two vehicles, one of them a large black Seat estate vehicle. They were taken away on low loaders for further examination. So that was a family property in Deal in Kent. Then about a 40-minute drive away, outside the town of Ashford in Kent, there was a wooded area, a lot of police activity and searching going on there. And it was in that area that police found human remains yesterday afternoon. Now, no confirmation that they are the remains of Sarah Everard, but I think the fact that the Met Police Commissioner came out and made that statement, we can join up the dots. And I think, you know, awful, awful news. The fact that it went from a missing persons inquiry to the news coming through yesterday afternoon that the man arrested on suspicion of kidnap had been rearrested on suspicion of murder.
If the body is that of Sarah Everard, it was found a long, long way from where she disappeared.
Yeah, geographically, this makes no sense. People have been trying to figure this out. It's extraordinary, really. Clapham in southwest London, where she was last seen, a CCTV image taken from one of those ringer doorbell devices. So Clapham in southwest London, 9 p.m. Wednesday last week. She was walking back to Brixton in south London. 2 miles should have taken her about 45 minutes maximum. And then, you know, Kent is a completely different. It's a rural area where the body was found in the woodland outside Ashford. Makes no sense at all. It is a long, long way from where she was last seen. So people have been trying to work out what happened, how someone could simply vanish off the face of the earth. You know, there was no reports of any scream or any struggle, no sighting of any altercation or incident. It makes no sense. What we know so far makes no sense whatsoever.
What more can you tell us about the man who's been arrested?
He's in his 40s, and it has been confirmed, because the Metropolitan Police have told us this, that he is one of their own. He is a serving Metropolitan Police officer. He was working in the Diplomatic Protection Squad, so he was an armed officer who would have been quite used to patrolling embassies in and around central London, protection of diplomats. We know that he is 48 years of age, a serving Metropolitan Police officer, and the woman then was arrested on suspicion of assisting an offender. So two people in custody. They were questioned yesterday, and I would imagine in the next couple of hours, detectives will begin questioning them again.
Looking at some of Cressida Dick's comments last night, she also said it's incredibly rare for a woman to be abducted from the streets, but that people, and particularly women, may be feeling understandably worried and scared. This has really reignited the debate about women's safety, hasn't it?
It has, and I thought it was quite noticeable yesterday on social media. You know, a lot of people make a decision. You know, I read a lot of the social media posts yesterday, women just pointing out that, you know, a split-second decision, do I walk down that alleyway? Do I cut through this park? You know, what if I go for a run down there? It really has, and I think people have been very, very worried and concerned, and it has sparked quite a debate, certainly online here, about women's safety. And, you know, I noticed a lot of comments coming back from men in particular saying, well, how should we change our behaviour to make you feel more safe? But I think it obviously has hit home, that element of the debate yesterday, because for the commissioner to come out and make a statement like she did last night, it's almost unprecedented.
Sky News senior reporter Enda Brady. And later on Morning Ireland, the discussion on the safety of women in public spaces continued, as Dr. Cliona Sadler of the Rape Crisis Network Ireland discussed why she thinks the case of Sarah Everard has resonated with so many women.
I think it touched a chord for a number of reasons, and it's not the first time we've aired this conversation, but it certainly touched a chord again. It sparked a massive response on social media, in part because this is your example of your stranger rape, and it is most likely stranger rape, but it is, you know, someone going about their daily lives and moving about in public in a way that all of us do and need to do. And and really, I suppose one of the questions was, what is the message being sent to women? And the sent to women is the same message they've been getting for all their lives, which is the world is unsafe for them and we must shrink our world to keep ourselves safer. And the response very clearly is actually, sorry, this is the wrong message. What we need is our freedom. And what we need to establish is how women can move about freely in the world and not have their lives curtailed by essentially men's violence against women. And so I suppose, you know, I'm connecting it, and I think a lot of people are connecting it with International Women's Day, which happened on Monday. And indeed, the Citizens' Assembly is about to look at gender equality and sexual and domestic violence. And really what you're looking at here is how the violence met out to women shrinks our world and, in fact, undermines any attempt to bring about gender equality.
And it was the fact that, you know, women were being warned by, you know, police to stay in after dark, that while you say as stranger rape is rare, the experiences of so many women, and, you know, texting your friend, you're home safe, being careful about darkness, you know, avoiding laneways, crossing the street to avoid a bunch of men, locking the car door immediately. Yeah. These are things that so many women do automatically that most men don't have to do. And it's almost, you had women saying, why are we having to do this?
It's an additional labour. It is, if you like, a tax on being a woman in the world. You have an additional labour, emotional, your headspace is taken up with it, and you're shrinking your world the whole time, or you're taking what you know to be a risk. It is one of the anomalies that we think of masculinity, you know, as being the gender which takes risks, when in fact women are taught from the very beginning that to engage in the public world, and indeed sometimes the domestic world, is to take risks. One of the studies that I came across today showed that 14-year-old girls lived, the public world they lived in, the size of the public space they occupied was 2/5 of the size they occupied when they were 11. So moving into puberty shrinks a girl's world. And in fact, when compared with her counterparts, her fellow 14-year-olds, her world was 1/3 the size of a boy's world by the time she was 14. Women's worlds shrink, and they shrink because of male violence.
Final point, just very briefly, though, as you will know in the Rape Crisis Network, the reality for most women most vulnerable is that the danger lies not out on the street, but behind your front door.
Absolutely. There is, and this is part of the problem of focusing on women in terms of women being able to prevent and protect themselves. There is no set of rules or safety guidance that will protect women. What we need to do is change how women are treated in the world, how women are objectified in the world, and the respect women have in the world.
Dr. Cliona Sadler of the Rape Crisis Network speaking to Áine Lawler on Morning Ireland. Later on in the day, Jo Duffy gave victims of violence a forum to share their stories and discuss their experience of the judicial system. Some of these stories are hard to hear, so please bear that in mind. First up, he heard from Mary Lynch, who was attacked by a passenger in her taxi.
I picked up the guy and brought him to Virginia, and we were down at Cul-de-sac, and he got out of the car. I thought he was going to do a rubber, and he opened the car door and proceeded to kick me into the car. He then bit me on my bare skin. He tried choking me. I was black and blue. He pulled lumps of hair out of my head. And this all happened like at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, God. And the after effects of that attack, we'll talk shortly about what happened to this man, Jerry McGrath, and what he went on to do horrifically. But the after effects of the attack on you, Mary, even today?
Yes, it stays with you forever. It stays with you forever. And that's why I rang in when I heard that man was saying that he didn't want to go to court. That is the worst thing. You need to be in the court. You need to... And it's like you're supposed to be encouraged to go. Because if you have a judge hearing a case and he has got the person in front of him who did the deed, and you don't have a victim there, it's like reading a story off a page. You're hearing from somebody else's voice talking about you, but the judge will have no one to look at, that it was me it happened to, or this man that it happened to. You're not human. It's just like a story and somebody else is reading it.
And when this woman who was attacked savagely on Blackhorse Avenue, when she says, I have nightmares, I jump when I'm out on the road and if someone runs past me.
Yes. I never used to wear earphones when I'm out walking, and my husband got me some for Christmas.
Yeah.
And I was walking along and someone came up behind me that I knew and put their hand on my shoulder and I nearly, so then I didn't wear them then for the rest of that walk.
And then And in your home, Mary, what do you do?
Oh, well, in my home, my doors are locked. I lock all my doors inside.
Oh, your interior doors as well as your exterior doors?
Yes. All doors are locked at night time.
Wow.
Every door is locked at night time. Because it's just, you now know what's going to happen. That's the awful thing about, before this, I would never have thought of this. You know, I would have never thought that somebody could break in or... It's what I could think about, but it wouldn't worry me that much. Now I'm wondering, if they break in, what can I do? What will I do? And then I lock the doors. I say, well, if they have to break in through here, I'll hear the noise and I can ring the guards or, all that business. Or I can get out the bedroom window or that sort of thing.
And why weren't you in court, Mary?
Because I was told, well, first of all, I got a phone call on the Saturday before the court to say that my case was not going ahead on the Monday.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fine. I was very disappointed because I had myself geared up to go, and because the guards knew I wanted to go because I had said it often enough. And I heard no more until the Monday evening. A man who I'd never spoken to before, who gave me his name, I didn't know who he was, and as far as I knew, he had nothing to do with my case. He told me that, as he said, your man got 9 months. But he only got 9 months. You see, my case, it happened to me in April. It was in a district court, and yet it took till after the following Christmas to go to court. So in that time, he had then attacked a child and murdered a woman.
Yeah.
But my big thing was not being in the court, because I don't know what was said. Now, I was told that they put up a great case. But I don't know. I wasn't there. That judge didn't look at me and said, this is the woman that was beaten up by this man.
Going about your work, completely unprovoked. Yeah. Okay, Mary, and this man, Jerry McGrath, went on to murder Sylvia Roach Kelly. Savagely, and he attacked a child as well.
That's correct, in the October.
He broke into a house, didn't he?
Yes, that's my memory. Kicked the child out of the house.
Okay, Mary, stay with us, please, because I want to talk to Sinead O'Leary. Sinead, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
You're on WhatsApp. And Sinead, these events that we're hearing about, from Black Horse Avenue to London to Seamus Troy, his attack happened in Europe, in Cork. It brings back the horrific events that visited your life in 2002. You and your friend,
yes,
Nicholas Sweeney.
Yeah.
You were in the safety you thought of.
Of Nicola's home,
yeah.
You know, you hear wrong place, wrong time. We were exactly where we should be of a Saturday evening in the safety of her home when an intruder broke in. We didn't know him. He lived nearby. He had already had previous convictions. He was known in the area. Earlier that night, he caused a commotion in a bar, tried to smash a glass ashtray on a barman's head. The guards came to the scene. He was told to go home because there was a summons waiting for him for a previous attack on two girls on the New Year's Eve 4 months prior. And on his way home, he spotted a boy on the road and he was going to murder him with a rock. He decided it would be too messy. He went home and got some knives. And that's when he was attracted to Nicola's house. He scaled the gates. Came in the back door, came up to her room. He didn't speak and just immediately launched a vicious attack on me, stamped on me and threw me to the ground. And then pulled out, showed Nicola the knives in his belt and started stabbing me. I was stabbed nearly 20 times. I was just fortunate enough that I was able to use my arms to defend my vital organs. And then when I probably assumed I was dead at that stage. He ran to Nicola, who tried to lock herself in her ensuite, but her towel got stuck under the door. And Nicola was stabbed 11 times and she died in her room. And then he left. Then I fled to a bathroom and he left the house. Mm-hmm. He went home, he showered, and he returned to the scene of the crime, acting like a concerned neighbour while my family was there, the guards were there. And everything at that stage, it was just a motiveless crime. It was just no rhyme or reason for it at all.
And Peter Whelan stood outside the gate as the families arrived,
the ambulance arrived.
Stood
outside. He stood outside the front door when my parents were there, as I had rang my parents for help as well after I'd alerted the guards.
Now, I know, given the horror of that and the death of poor Nicola, your friend, a daughter, a sister. You don't need anything to bring that back. That's with you. But just listening to the Sarah Everard case, Seamus Troy on Monday, and this case on Black Horse Avenue. What does that say to you, Sinead, in terms of your since the horrific attack and the murder of Nicola? Do you take extra precautions? Do you suffer flashbacks?
It changes your life completely, suffering that level of a trauma. And particularly, I mean, for me, it was constantly in the media because of all his appeals. He was unremorseful. Yeah. His appealing was relentless. 2 years ago, we were in the position where Nicola's family and I were under the impression that he would have been about 2 or 3 years in his life sentence for Nicola's murder at that stage. And then we found out, because of a prime time investigation, that he had had 3 or 4 illegal parole hearings and was having day releases back in Cork. And that completely derailed my life. I'd worked very hard for a very long time to regain some sense of peace and security in my life. And that has taken all of that from me. I mean, I was the state witness in a murder trial, and yet I wasn't included in those parole hearings. Neither were Nicola's parents. We weren't given any opportunity to submit victim impact statements and for us to find out that he had been back in Cork, where we all live, on numerous occasions was absolutely devastating and traumatizing for all of us. And it's the last 2 years now have been horrendous for us all, you know.
And nobody came near you when Peter Whelan was, before he was got temporary release or day release, to call it.
No, as in we should have been able to submit victim impact statements. We should have been made aware of those parole hearings. It's a really important part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, we were never acknowledged. We've never been considered. I mean, I campaign for exclusion zones for families bereaved by murder. I don't think that those families should ever have to live alongside those people. I think it's inhumane. I mean, at this stage, it's, for me, I just feel completely disposable by the state as a witness.
Mm.
I feel like that not only is my mental health at stake moving forward, but my own personal safety. I mean, the only regrets he expressed were that he didn't do more to kill me. You know, and I now live in a position where I'm waiting for, there's a parole hearing underway at the moment. I'm waiting to be emailed to be told if he's being released or not. And based on that, I would have to uproot my whole life and move away to protect myself.
And do you think, is there a parole hearing going on at the moment, Sinead, as far as you know?
There is. It was scheduled for November and we're still waiting to hear what the outcome of that was. You know, that's, so you're living in that moment too. You know, it's frightening.
And have you been asked to submit it?
Yes, I have this time, because I found out about it. So I was able to submit this time.
And what way, what way did you make that submission, Sinead? Did you write it or could you?
I wrote it. I mean, under the new Parole Act, I mean, once that is up and running, you should be able to submit orally and hopefully with a bit more support, which needs to happen. So this was a written statement this time. Whereas, you know, I would be campaigning for more support and more rights for victims in that sense as well, and more support when they are undergoing these parole hearings.
And in making the submission, first of all, I take your point about being allowed to make it orally, but also it can be very difficult to write it down.
Extremely. And there's a lot of pressure there too.
Yeah.
You know, you're having to relive, you get 3 weeks to do it. You know, that took every minute of every day for 3 weeks out of me writing that. You're having to revisit all of that trauma and you're having to write to the person who committed these crimes against you. It's not private. You're only allowed to submit once you acknowledge that they will be receiving a copy, which I feel makes me even more vulnerable because I'm putting up roadblocks to his release in that sense.
He can read it. His legal team can read it. And
I'm not allowed to submit unless I give permission for him to read it.
And
whereas I wouldn't have access to anything that he's submitted or anything that he says in his parole hearings, and neither does Nicola's family. You know, it's a very unbalanced system.
And Sinead, you said you spent 3 weeks writing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you do that? How did you keep together?
Well, it was difficult, but you know, I'm fighting for my survival and I'm fighting for my rights and I'm fighting for Nicola. You know,
and you're fighting for other victims as well, especially in your case and Mary's case, and the Black Horse Avenue case, as we're calling it, women attacked, completely unprovoked attacks, and the aftermath and what can happen. And your worry is that Whelan. How many pages was your submission for a finish?
It was about 9,000 words. I wrote a lot. I put my heart and soul into it. It was a lot. Do you know,
that's incredible. And what way did you structure it? Were you given guidance on how to structure it?
No, nothing at all. Nothing at all. I mean, I just started from the start, what happened that night and what the real and lasting effect that has had on me, you know, and to know the events of that night. I mean, I could say even 10 years after that night, I still wasn't able to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night because I would live in fear that my whole family could have been massacred, because that's the reality that I lived in, that someone could come into your home and kill your loved ones, you know.
And Sinead, I just think that's an incredible achievement on so many levels. One, that you were able to sit down and write 9,000 words. It's a short novel, to say the least.
Yeah, and I think people underestimate how difficult it is to actually do that, and particularly for family members to have to do that, and they feel as if that's their only avenue to get justice. You know, it's and there's no support when you're doing that. You know, no one's sitting beside you helping you with that. You know, it was a very difficult time doing that for me. You know, you want to be able to move on with your life, to be able to live your life despite of what's happened, but there's no space to do that.
And as you say, when the shadow on your shoulder when you're writing it is that this man, this murderer, I know that people will take issue with that and face the charges, but this man will read this, and this man could be out on the streets of your city very soon.
Yeah. You know, it's very intimidating, and it's, you know, but I mean, he attempted to take my life, so I have to continue to fight for my life, you know.
And Mary, where is Gerry McGrath now? I know he's in for the horrific killing of Sylvia, and broke into a house and tried to abduct a child from her bed. Where is he now, Mary? Are you kept abreast of where he is and what's happening?
No, I did fight because I have actually no rights, because I didn't die. So I really have no rights. The family, Sylvia Roach Kelly's family, will be informed when he's getting out, but I would have had no rights. But now I have, because I got on to the prison service and I spoke to people, and they're to ring me when he's getting out.
So you made yourself heard?
Yes, I made myself heard, all right. But it doesn't do, you see, the problem is victims get nothing. The victims get nothing. We get, like, I wasn't even allowed to go to that court, which is something I really wanted to do. But we get nothing. Like, remember that the person who does the crime gets psychiatric help. They get barristers. They get solicitors. They have everything there for them.
Yeah.
Victims don't have that. Victims have nothing. And nobody, you know, and once it's over, you're sort of like, if you say anything or talk about it afterwards, you're nearly told, well, if you stop talking about it, you get over it, you'll be fine. Or why are you doing the job? Like someone said to me, you're not still doing the job, are you? And I said, well, yes, I am. I don't have a choice. I pay to pay bills. But they were, well, you shouldn't be doing that. You're a woman. But I should be doing it.
And I don't want the name of the person, but what was the status of the person that said that to you?
They were just an ordinary, everyday person
who
would have known me, and some a relation with another one.
As if your job was somehow at fault.
Yes.
I
was at fault for doing the job. Yeah. It'd be more like it.
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
You know, and like that's what people say. People say, like, that woman in England, it's what will be said about her is, why was she walking at that hour? The woman from Blackhall that you've just been speaking to, why was she going out at 7 o'clock in the morning for a walk on her own? Why not? Is my answer. Why not?
Why not? Mary Lynch and Sinead O'Leary on Liveline. We heard Joe Duffy today refer to Sarah Grace's interview on Claire Byrne, and here it is. Sarah is a survivor of a violent sexual attack, who's speaking up publicly about her difficult time navigating the court system and her efforts to improve the process for other survivors of sexual assault. This is a tough listen, so please take care.
On the night of Wednesday, July 17th, 2019, solicitor Sarah Grace was attacked in her own apartment. She had left a window open on the security latch, but woke in the night to find a stranger in her room on her bed. Ibrahim El Ghanawi, of no fixed abode, was sentenced to 10 years in jail for the assault on Sarah Grace. He had 33 previous convictions. During the attack, he attempted to strangle her. He violently penetrated her with a punch and caused internal damage. Sarah managed to escape her attacker and raise the alarm with her flatmates. Now, Sarah, you decided to speak to Una Mullally in the Irish Times and to me today because you want to see changes in the system, in the way that victims are dealt with throughout cases like yours. But before we get to that, that night in 2019, as I said, you didn't know the man, you'd never met him, he wasn't known to your flatmates. This was a random burglary type entry, and then he attacked you in your bed.
Hi, Claire. Thanks for having me. And yeah, so exactly that. I didn't know him. It started off as a burglary. I think he had burgled two houses before ours, or one house before ours, anyway. And then it took a turn for the worst.
So you were, as I said, asleep in your bed that night. Do you want to take us through as much as you're comfortable with telling us happened on that evening?
Sure. I won't go into too much detail just because Una's brilliant article actually covered that extensively. But for those who don't know the story, I woke up during the night and the first thing I realised is that there was this weight on my chest. I couldn't really breathe. There was something constricting my throat. And there was that kind of a horror movie moment where I realised there was a man on top of me, a complete stranger. And there were two very violent struggles where he tried to strangle me and stop me from screaming. And I tried to run away twice. And he chased me down the corridor of my bedroom. And there was a second, again, very violent struggle where he tried to, again, strangle my throat, stop me from screaming. I fought back. I actually bit off a piece of his hand, which is hard to believe in hindsight, but I managed to get away, but not before he kind of committed his crime of aggravated sexual assault, which was he essentially, as I was running away, just kind of jammed his hand up me, basically. So then we escaped. I grabbed my two flatmates and we jumped out a window, and then the guards arrived shortly afterwards.
Can I just ask you, when you were involved in this violent struggle and you talk about the strength that you found, and I'm sure looking back you don't know where that came from, but thankfully you found it from somewhere to fight back. Your flatmates who were living with you at the time, did they hear that happening?
I don't think they heard initially. I think I live on one end of the flat, they live on the other. So I think they only heard me once I made it into the entrance hall, and they heard the screams then. But I think the struggle in my head lasted a long time. I'd say it might have been between 2 and 5 minutes. It feels like a lot longer to me, but I don't think they heard at that stage.
So did you all flee the apartment together then?
One of my flatmates and I ran into her room and we jumped out her window. The other followed shortly afterwards. We tried to text her or call her to get her to come, but at this stage, we still thought he was coming after us. So we were trying to be as quiet as possible and trying to call the guards. We were looking for somewhere to hide and there wasn't really anywhere because it's Grand Canal Docks. Nowhere is open at 3 a.m. on a Tuesday night. So we called a taxi, actually, to hide in the taxi while the guards arrived.
OK, and where was he at that point? Had he run?
He had run, yeah. So when I eventually made my way back into the room with the guards, he had run back out the window, so back out on the street and stolen all my property, like all my phone, iPad, you know, jewelry boxes, handbag, wallet, everything, to add insult to injury. So I don't know. I think he left very shortly after the struggle.
You say in your interview with Una and indeed today that your process of healing began straight away with the sexual assault treatment unit in the Rotunda.
Yeah, and that's the kind of what I really want to focus on now is the healing and the kind of practicalities for survivors. And I can't stress enough how important that those first few hours were for me anyway. It was very much a question of taking your power back and kind of taking your dignity back as well. And the men and women and people who work in SATU are just mind-blowing. They're so calm, professional, kind, but they know what they're looking for. So we were kind of doing a full body check and looking for bruises and cuts, and every time we saw a bite mark or something like that, that would get me quite panicked because I hadn't realized the extent of my injuries. They were actually quite happy because they were recording this down and saying, look, this is great evidence for trial. And that just completely switched my perspective, where we were doing something you know, actively doing something, already gathering evidence for the trial. And they were also, you know, kind of cleaning up the wounds and so on and disinfecting. So it was that kind of double physically healing, but also mentally healing, because you are already taking action to take your power back, basically.
And then the weeks, the days, the months after the attack, how were you afterwards? I know you sought counselling, didn't you?
I did, yeah. So, I mean, the effects of the attack, I mean, can't be downplayed. Like, I was in a huge state of shock and dissociation. My body felt completely foreign to me. Any kind of sudden noise or even a strong smell, like a strong perfume, would completely trigger me. You know, panic attacks. You know, I couldn't sleep. I couldn't really bear to be alone, but I couldn't bear to be touched either. And I found what helped me hugely in that is, first of all, the therapy. So the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, or indeed all the Rape Crisis Centre, wherever you are in Ireland, they are phenomenal. They really treat you with respect. They listen to you, but there's no pity. They're just there to help. And that's certainly what was hugely healing to me. And I cannot emphasize enough the importance of going to them, and they really work with you at your level. So for example, I'm a yoga teacher. I would do a lot of grounding exercises or physical yoga exercises or breathing to kind of come back to myself. And they would really work with that and kind of give me extra insights on what I could do or add to that. So that helped a huge amount. And the other thing I would say for all survivors, or even, you know, friends and family, colleagues of survivors, is throw yourself, body and mind, into things that give you joy. And they might seem so insignificant, but if you sprinkle those throughout your day, and, you know, I mean, I was doing things like a colorful porridge bowl or a nice walk somewhere and grabbing a photo, just something so small. But if you kind of get into that practice every day of just seeking joy in the small things, it really snowballs into something a lot bigger. And that really helps your healing as well. Or at least that's what I found. And obviously everyone is completely different. But I think that's a huge lesson in resilience, of just trying to find the joy even in, you know, the effects of an incredibly traumatic event.
Well, there's the trauma of the event, and then there's the trauma of having to go through the court case. It was 18 months, wasn't it, before a trial date was set, and then there was talk of it being delayed further because of COVID.
Exactly. So 18 months, I was told, was almost unheard of in terms of speed, which really shocked me. I mean, I think I was talking to Nolene Blackwell about this, who's the head of the Rape Crisis Centre. You know, something like this, like sexual violence or any sexual offence, really, it affects you in a way, you know, other crimes might not affect you. Like, it really goes to the core psyche of someone, or that's what I found anyway. And, you know, during that time, you're not really allowed to talk about the trial to anyone because you don't want to prejudice the trial in any way. So it's an extra layer of just feeling like you have to stay in the shadows, one, because you don't want to make people uncomfortable and, you know, you want to stick to maybe more palatable discussions, but also you're so worried about this trial and you have to say nothing until you get to trial. So we waited for 18 months, and about 2 weeks before the trial started, so I had flown home to be with family in France for a little while, and we were, you know, imminently flying back for the quarantine and told that the trial was delayed by a year, even though we were supposed to have priority because he was on bail. And when, you know, the court system tells you this, it's kind of a faceless thing. Like, there's no one person making a decision. I mean, the judge ultimately made the decision, but you're kind of told by someone who told someone who told someone, and there's no way for you to defend yourself. You have no legal representation in these trials, which I found really shocking. You're not a victim, you're a witness for the purpose of the trial, which is shocking to me that we can treat victims in that way.
Yeah, and we'll talk a bit about that, Sarah, about the court experience, because the case did go ahead after the 18 months, as you said. Now, your experience in court is really something that you want to talk about, because as a solicitor, I would have thought that you would have expected to see what happened, but for you it was absolutely shocking. And a simple thing, like you wanted a screen between you and the accused in court, and it was really difficult to get that done.
Yeah, and Claire, that's another reason why I'm coming forward is, you know, like I'm a solicitor, I'm not a litigator, I would do corporate law, but I have a little bit of experience, probably more than most people would, of the courts and certainly the criminal justice system. And I found it incredibly difficult to navigate that system. And I honestly was shocked to my core at how victims were being treated. And I think the public would be shocked to know certain specifics of it, but also, you know, things need to change, but change takes time. So in the shorter term, I think it might be useful for survivors to know the kind, I've kind of highlighted three or four, or want to go through three or four kind of key examples of the issues that I found, just so that they can know. And I really want to flag here that as grim of a picture as I may paint of the court system, I really do not try to dissuade anyone from going to court. That is your decision. But there are things I wish I had known in order to be better prepared. So that's what I'm trying to do now. Okay. So in relation to the screen, it's you are entitled under the Criminal Justice Act to give your evidence behind a screen if the judge finds it's in the interest of justice. And it's actually a huge process. You have to put in an application and do a vulnerability assessment. And you have to prove that you need to be protected from repeat victimization, intimidation, or retaliation by the accused. It's a really lengthy process, and the judge only makes the decision once the trial starts. So you have that looming over you that you might have to give evidence next to the offender. And I cannot emphasize, Claire, how close you are seated to the offender while you are giving evidence, like you are in touching distance of each other, which absolutely shocked me. And there was no way I could have given evidence if I hadn't had that screen.
So it wasn't an option for you. If you had been looking at him, or if he had been able to look at you, you just couldn't go ahead, is what you're saying.
I think I would have tried to, but to be honest with you, Claire, I don't know how I would have gotten through it. I think I would just have had a panic attack, because in the attack, I didn't quite see his face, but I did see his eyes for a split second. And I just really don't want to put a face to the nightmares. You know, I'm much better at managing it now, but if I had seen his face then, I don't know how I would have given proper evidence to the jury and judge, to be honest. So there's an element of, you know, you're almost denying justice and denying proper evidence to the judge by not having the screen. And the reason they push against it is it makes him look guilty. And I think that's crazy. I mean, the nature of a sexual offense is such that you would want some kind of separation between the victim and the offender. And if you made it an automatic thing, it wouldn't make him look guilty, because they would do it for everyone.
Mm-hmm. It would be happening across the board. Was it a jury trial?
It was a jury trial, yeah. So it was 11 men and one woman.
Your counselling notes as well. I know that you want to tell people about this, and you mentioned that you went to the Rape Crisis Centre as part of your healing after what happened to you. But those counselling notes became part of the trial.
Yeah, and that was the biggest shock of them all. And I think certainly no one in, you know, my circle or family knew about this, and they were all shocked. I think the public would be shocked to know that when you go to therapy after, you know, a rape, a sexual violence or sexual assault incident, those notes, whether they're from the Rape Crisis Centre or not, by the way, it's any therapist, any counselling records, can be taken and will form part of the evidence in trial. And two things shocked me on that. One was, we're only doing this to discredit the victim. So all of my notes kind of lined up with what I was saying. So they weren't used to kind of back up my evidence. But if there was any discrepancy or anything that I had mentioned in there where I said, oh, maybe he didn't quite do that, but I think he did, anything like that, that would be used to discredit me, and defense could use that to discredit me. No other crime permits therapy notes to be used against a witness, particularly given the nature of a sexual offense. I think that is absolutely crazy. And that's just a legal provision that needs to go. it's just barbaric, to be honest with you.
Well, I would imagine it also affects how you would behave in counselling, quite apart from this being the most personal document about you possibly that exists, the counselling notes after you've been through something like this. But also, how much value is counselling to you if you know that what you're saying can be used in a courtroom?
Well, exactly. And the other thing that shocked me was I wasn't warned that this would happen by the guards and by the court system. So it was kind of 4 months after commencing therapy, and we're talking weekly therapy, Claire. You know, I'm opening up about my deepest, darkest thoughts following this in order to heal. And, you know, I'm doing that in the confidence of a counseling room. And out of nowhere, I'm told I need to sign over these counseling records. And if I don't sign them over, the judge can force the release anyway, and all you're doing is delaying the trial. Why are we putting sexual violence and rape victims through that kind of pressure when they're just trying to survive after, you know, such a traumatic attack? It just really doesn't make sense to me. Mm. And to add insult to injury, the therapy isn't even free. The Rape Crisis Center is not state subsidized. So you have to pay for your own therapy to then be used against you. And, you know, that's not the case for offenders that are in jail. You know, they're afforded free therapy, which is a good thing, and that can't be used against them, which is a good thing. But we're not affording that same right to the victim, which the system should be protecting.
Let's move on to the other issues that you have flagged as being hugely problematic. Do you want to talk about the victim impact statement?
Yeah, so this is kind of, it goes back to the fact that you are not considered a victim, you're considered a witness, yet at the end, you give a victim impact statement, which in itself is such a contradiction. It's kind of like having your cake and eating it too, that you don't want to give legal representation to these people who have no idea how the system works, and then you expect them to stand up, give evidence, and then give this victim impact statement. And what I found really difficult is, in that statement, it's the use of it is so that the judge can give proper sentencing and, you know, understand the impact of the crime on you. So again, it's, you're very much pouring your heart out on this document to, you know, list out everything honestly that has affected you. And as you probably know, sexual offenses are heard in camera, which means the public is not allowed, but the media is allowed to come in. And anything you say in that victim impact statement can be and will be reported on by the courts. And I was giving this victim impact statement, you know, I kind of covered everything that had impacted me, but there were some things I didn't want the public to know. Like, that was my own private matter. So I'm in the process of writing to the DPP and the Minister of Justice, because I think there should be a way for the victim to be consulted either before giving the statement or after, that they could say, look, there's aspects of this statement that I do not want reported on. And that to me would seem fair. There's plenty that the media could report on, but there might be something really specific in there. Like, say, you know, which is not my case, but say you had a bad relationship with your employer and you mentioned how the crime made that worse. You do not want that, you know, recorded on the media. And a lot of people had recognized me through the articles, even though I wasn't named in them, which ultimately kind of prompted me to go public, because I almost had nothing else to lose and I wanted to help survivors. But I found that was another huge blow, that you're it's such a private thing to just see splashed over the papers, and you're not even given the decency of a consultation to see, you know, do you want us to focus on something in particular? So I don't mean to curb, you know, free press, absolutely not. But there could be a way for the victim to say, look, I'm willing to speak to the press, but not waive anonymity. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
just on that, I'm just interested to know how you've dealt with waiving your anonymity and speaking about this publicly. You said, you know, I almost had nothing left to lose. How have you been since you decided to go public, Sarah?
I have to say I've been just floored and blown away by the response and the support from everyone. Like, I thought there would be a bit of a reaction. I was not expecting something to this scale. And I'm so grateful to people for reaching out, because, you know, this doesn't just concern victims. It also concerns their families, their friends, their wider circle. And it takes courage to speak up on something like this, because there's the natural human reaction that you don't want to intrude or you don't want to say the wrong thing. And everyone is very different on this, Claire. Like, I'm not saying all victims will want to come forward, but just sharing my experience, I found it hugely healing after almost 2 years of just being silenced about something that I wanted to speak up about, you know, and I just wanted the world to know, or at least my kind of circle and employers and colleagues to know what I was going through. And I wasn't allowed to talk about it. So to see people, you know, reach out and say the nicest things, and it was only words of huge support and encouragement and people sharing their stories, it makes you feel like you're not alone. And that was ultimately the reason why I came forward, was, you know, the first one was to reassure victims of rape and sexual violence that you're not alone and you really have nothing to hide or feel ashamed of, and you don't have to stay silent if you don't want to. That was ultimately my goal, in addition to highlighting the issues that I think we need to change in our court system.
What was the impact of the trial itself on you?
To be honest with you, Claire, in hindsight, it was worse than the attack. Now, I think there was a number of factors to that. And again, I am really not dissuading people from going to court, because I overall am very glad I did. Some people don't have, you know, they don't have enough evidence to go to court. So every situation is different. But, you know, there were huge delays by sometimes no one's fault. Like, there were, you know, there were issues with COVID and so on. And there were also issues that if I had been warned and if I had just been briefed on what to expect, and, you know, if I had legal representation to say, look, you know, in defense, they can ask you questions and they say things like, I put it to you, that means you can disagree. Or they'll say things like, the trial's been put back. That doesn't mean it's been delayed. Don't have a heart attack. It just means it's been put back 10 minutes. Just someone to explain the process to you would have been invaluable.
It's extraordinary that those things had an impact on you coming from a legal background. You can imagine somebody who doesn't come from a legal background, how it would impact the rest of us.
Exactly, Claire. And, you know, one of the reasons I'm sharing my story is not for the sake of the story at all. It's that I have, you know, one, some experience of the legal system, and now, you know, two, experience on the other side as the survivor. But I want to, I'm very conscious of the privileged situation I'm in. You know, I have that legal background. I was able to tell my family. I think there's a report that says 60% of survivors don't tell their family. So I had their support. I was able to advocate for myself in ways others might not. You know, the case was very clear cut. It was a stranger. There was no question around consent. So I want to share my insights with others so that they can be better prepared until we get the changes put in place, to just help them know what to expect and to know they can advocate for themselves. They can ask the questions. And they should be making, you know, making themselves a nuisance. Sometimes it feels that way, just to get the answers they need, because no one's fighting in the corner.
But I suppose your point is you shouldn't have to make a nuisance of yourself in order to be treated in the way that you would expect by the system. You've met with the DPP, and I know you're going to write both to the DPP and to the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee. Can you outline for us, Sarah, what you'll be saying in those letters?
Yeah, well, the DPP, I have to say, are, you know, every person I've dealt with in there, they're lovely to deal with, as were the guards, as were senior counsel. Like, this is almost the problem, is everyone you deal with is lovely. It's just the system that's broken. And I've outlined a few things to them already. And a lot of the things they do, you know, they can't change the law. So for them, it's more, look, you know, you're used to doing this. You might use terminology that people don't understand. Some of the communications I received by email were maybe not the most humanely written. And, you know, you want to keep in mind that the person you're talking to is already quite vulnerable, because you're coming up to this trial. And I cannot understate the impact that has on someone. To talk about the screen and the possibility to have the screen, and they're kind of the main ones for the DPP. For the letter to Helen McEntee, that'll be more I think, changes that need to happen on a legislative level. So, you know, the fact that we're still using therapy notes to discredit a witness, the fact that we can still sometimes question them on their sexual history is insane. You know, that the screen should be automatic. So there'll be, you know, changes that will probably take longer. And, you know, there's already huge movement happening in that area. Like, they're pushing forward this strategy called Supporting the Victim's Journey, which is great. And I've read the proposals. A lot of them are brilliant and to be welcomed, but I think they could go further and maybe be fleshed out a little bit more.
Okay, when it comes to your attacker, you've come to a level of forgiveness, have you?
I have, yeah, and it's a funny one because I forgave him quite soon after the attack because, you know, one, I don't know him, and two, it almost felt like I'd been mauled by a wild animal, to be honest with you. Like, I just, my brain couldn't register that a human had done that. So in that way, it was easier to forgive initially. But what happened was, over time and with the trial coming up, these feelings of anger just came back. And, you know, I started to realize, no, actually, this is really a person who understands what he's done, maybe, you know, doesn't fully understand the repercussions of his act. But it is still, you know, a person, someone's son, you know, maybe someone's sibling. So on forgiveness, it's really something that you do daily. It's not something that you do at one point in time and you're done. It's really something that you have to kind of carry with you and practice daily. And it's, there's so many layers to it of letting go. You have to kind of let go of your anger and let go of your resentment. It is a difficult one, and it's, you know, I'm by no means condoning what he did. Like, the act is almost unforgivable, but you know that expression, love the sinner, hate the sin.
Mm-hmm.
It's that perspective of just thinking.
And did you feel the sentence of 10 years reflected and acknowledged the seriousness of what he did?
That was another funny one. It was, I had very mixed emotions on it. We weren't expecting a sentence that long, so that was a surprise. There was an element of, at sentencing, I find that was the first time I felt acknowledged, and the number 10 kind of really reflected the impact it's had on my life. But at the same time, you know, you look at someone like that and they've really never had a chance. Like, I think he left his home country when he was quite young, didn't finish school, kind of has been fending for himself his whole life. And you think, he's just going to get worse in jail. Like, what we need actually is education in some way. And now I'm very glad he's no longer on the streets and no longer a threat to other women and people. But I hope that it's not just, you know, lock the door and throw away the key. I hope it is that there will be some kind of push to educate and explain, and maybe over time, you know, get him to understand what he's done and forgive himself as well.
Sarah Grace on Today with Claire Byrne. And if you've been affected by any of the issues brought up today, you can find contact details for support organisations online at rte.ie/support. And that's all I have for you today. Thanks for listening.